From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. And this morning we speak first with Dr. Jason Cryan, the executive director and an entomologist, a very interesting entomologist, at the Natural History Museum of Utah. Dr. Cryan will highlight the upcoming Bug Fest. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Natural History Museum. It's a big celebration of some of Utah's tiniest residents and what makes these tiny insects so fascinating and important.
And then we'll jump in with the University of Utah Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Anil Seth. He updates us on the remarkable discovery he and his team made of an intermediate black hole in Omega Centauri, and why we should care.
That all coming up on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Our guest this morning is a scientist, a leader, a passionate advocate for science, natural history, and education. Dr. Jason Cryan is the executive director at the Natural History Museum of Utah.
Also, Dr. Cryan brings deep expertise in evolutionary biology and, as an entomologist, explores the biodiversity of some of the world's most curious and colorful insects, and a global perspective shaped by fieldwork in more than 20 tropical countries.
Dr. Cryan's work is rooted in curiosity, education, and a commitment to public engagement. He joins us now to talk about the Natural History Museum's Bug Fest taking place this weekend, August 9th and 10th, for a weekend of insect-inspired fun featuring expert-led workshops, edible bug treats, and a spotlight on the incredible praying mantis. Jason Cryan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning, and thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful to see you again.
Yes, and I should say welcome back, because we've talked to you about bugs before, and you make it so fun. First of all, how many times in your life have you been asked to explain, as I'm going to ask you to explain, the difference between etymology and entomology?
There's a joke in there somewhere that I would mess up if I tried, but... etymology, of course, is the science or study of words, of language. And entomology, what I am, I study insects in all our various shapes and forms.
That's good. I wonder how, I mean, the Latin roots, bases of those two words must have some connection in there somewhere, but not very close. Or it's just happenstance, I guess, that they're spelled one without that N, right, and the other with the N. Okay, well, how did you get interested in bugs?
So, interestingly, I was not a bug kid. So if you speak with many entomologists, they'll tell you that they were, as kids, running around studying bugs and collecting bugs and all those things. That wasn't me. I was the kid who was always out in nature growing up, and so I just had a deep love of all things in the natural world. I grew up in New England, in Vermont, and I was born, I'll date myself here, I was born on the same year that Earth Day was born, 1970. And so I grew up in Vermont, which is kind of known to be a bit of a hippie place. I grew up kind of having these dreams of biodiversity and exploration and the world's living things and natural wonders kind of running through my head. So that's how I grew up, and I got into my undergraduate studies at the University of Vermont. I partook in some undergraduate research credits, and they paired me up with an old entomologist there in Vermont who was just fascinating. He really had a great sense of humor, and he knew everything about everything. He took us out to the field, and that's how I got into insects. He just jazzed me with the world of insects.
Jazzed you with the world of insects. So I know we're going to talk about the praying mantis at some point, and I think the praying mantis is probably one of those things when we see it as a young person, it excites just about anyone. It's such a curious thing. So, well, let me ask you then, was the praying mantis part of that inspiration?
Absolutely. So I have the maybe dubious honor of just being really excited about all kinds of weird things. And so the weirder the better, and certainly praying mantises are part of that weirdness. They're just absolutely phenomenal organisms. They're consummate predators. They have all very interesting different kind of lifestyles, different species of different ways of hunting and predating. And they're just endlessly fascinating. I am not a praying mantis specialist myself. I study other things that are equally weird and charismatic. But interestingly, I do have a very personal connection to praying mantises. I trained a good friend and colleague of mine as a postdoctoral researcher in my laboratory when I was at the New York State Museum, Dr. Gavin Svensson, who is one of the world's, if not the world's, preeminent praying mantis experts. And so I do have a very personal friend and connection with the praying mantis world.
Very cool. But, you know, there's oodles and oodles of bugs in the world, as we know. I'm just curious, you know, what role do some of the, you know, lesser known insects play in the broader ecological systems that you study?
Sure. Well, it's a great question. And you know, I can't tell you how many times I've been asked, especially by my mother, as I became an entomologist, can you just do something about those mosquitoes or those, you know, biting flies? You know, the answer really is that species have evolved over many, many years, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, to fill a role. And very often as humans, we don't understand what that role might be. But I can assure you that each of those organisms out there that have evolved and have taken their place in the environment, they do play a role. We're seeing that most poignantly now in the global decline of insects. So, you know, in terms of study after study for the past decade or so or more have shown that the numbers of species have declined and the absolute biomass of insects has declined significantly. So not only the components of the ecosystem are lesser now than they had been, but also just the sheer numbers of things. And that is effect that we're seeing that's measurable and quantifiable. It's, you know, data that we can collect. But that global decline in insect life is now contributing as a cascading effect to the decline of other things that we can now take note of. Most notably, I have many friends who are ornithologists. They're bird watchers. And they have noted the significant decline of bird fauna as a direct result of the decline of insects. So, you know, no matter whether we believe or whether we understand a role of a particular insect in the environment or not, we can be assured that they are playing a role, and they're, whether it's as abundant food for other animals or as predators, as decomposers, as pollinators, you know, there's just so many environmental niches that insects fill, and we should just be aware of all of that.
So it sounds like there's a fundamental shift then in biodiversity that's going on if we lose part of our insect population.
Absolutely. So insects, of course, are ubiquitous components of almost every ecosystem, certainly all terrestrial ecosystems, and to some degree, to a much lesser degree, marine ecosystems, but freshwater aquatic ecosystems. You know, insects are such fundamental and important and essential components of all of those things that as they decline, as they disappear, we just don't know what the ramifications of that decline will be.
So, Jason, when it comes to hosting Bug Fest every year, as you do, what is your hope for general, you know, raising awareness among young people, but also among older people?
So this is such a great question, and it's something that's is such an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? So we encounter young people here, kiddos who come in, and they are just absolutely excited and curious and thrilled about insects. And we see a sharp decline in that curiosity and interest somewhere in the early, you know, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, early teens, especially among girls, but really across both boys and girls. And it's hard to assign blame for how that happens, but very clearly as adults, it's very common to see people say, "Oh, don't touch that because it's icky, or it's dirty. You know, it's dirty, or it'll sting you, or something like that." You know, so with Bugfest, we're really excited and thrilled about the opportunity to bring the wonder back to the insect world, to our community, to learn to love insects. But before you love insects, you have to understand them. And so we hope to educate and then to inspire not only an appreciation for, but really a passion for all natural the world, but in this particular case, insects.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Dr. Jason Cryan. He is the executive director of the Natural History Museum of Utah. He's also an evolutionary biologist and an entomologist, and he's talking to us today about the wonder of bugs and Bug Fest coming up this weekend at the Natural History Museum. What an incredible facility, the Natural History Museum of Utah. If any of our listeners haven't been there, you simply must go. I just marvel at, you know, first of all, from the outside, architecturally, it's so beautiful. And then you get in the inside and your whole sense of wonder opens up. As the executive director, you know, what do you feel about the place?
Well, it's a bit of a loaded question, and I'll admit right off the bat that I'm biased, but I'll be the biggest cheerleader for this place. This museum is really awe-inspiring. You know, we're part of the University of Utah. We're also the state's designated natural history museum. We have just a phenomenal facility. As you mentioned, this building is just absolutely architecturally stunning. It reflects the major geologic features across Utah, with natural land bridges, bridges across the canyon and our grand entranceway, and all kinds of other aspects of the building. The content in this museum is just a model. It's absolutely stunning. As I said, you know, we play host very, very proudly, and I'm honored to say that we play host to teams of professionals from other museums across the nation and across the world who come here because they've heard about us and they want to model how we do things here. Having it right here in Utah is just what a resource, what a gem in the crown of our state.
Well, I understand that during Bugfest, correct me if I'm wrong, that people actually have a chance to sample bugs, if I've got that correct. And as somebody who's ridden their bike down a hill with their mouth open, I think I've sampled a lot of bugs myself. Any favorites on the menu?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked. So, you know, as I said, this is a Bugfest in general, one of our four large signature public festivals a year. This is the big summer festival. This is our opportunity to, you know, bring people to a level of understanding and education about insects and an inspiration and love of insects. And that includes the idea of insects being used as food. You know, insects are used as a protein source around the world. In fact, in the U.S. here, we are one of the few cultures, communities that don't willingly eat insects and knowingly eat insects. But many cultures and many communities around the world do. And so we have this amazing, very fun offering throughout the day in Bugfest, both days, Saturday and Sunday. We call it Bug Bar. And so I team up with a good friend and colleague of mine, Megan Bartley, who's in the Department of Anthropology here at the University of Utah. She's also been a professional chef. And so she creates recipes using insect ingredients. And then we talk about it. We present it to a whole crowd of very enthusiastic insect edible food aficionados. So we really encourage you to come and try it out. So the way we structure this is Megan makes four different dishes, four different recipes, and they kind of increase in what I would say adventurousness, if that's a word. And we start with a dish that in which you can't see any insect ingredients. You know intellectually that you're eating something, but you can't see anything. It's just hidden. And I can give you the menu. It's not really a secret here. This is, we're starting out this year with chocolate cricket cake. So it's a lava cake kind of consistency, really nice chocolate cake, using cricket flour. And I had one this morning, actually. It was phenomenal. Megan outdid herself. So we start with dessert this year. The next level up is when you can kind of see insects in the meal, but it's still subtle. And so this year, Megan has put together honey citrus fruit salad with black ants. And so black ants, when roasted, have a bit of a citrus tang themselves. And so it pairs beautifully with this citrus salad, a fruit salad that she's put together. So that's going to be fantastic. The next level, for those who are adventurous and would like to join us to partake, is when you can actually see the insects in the dish. And so she has put together a mealworm fried rice, which gives a little salty taste. So we went from sweet to tart to salty in the third course. And that's going to be exciting. But you can actually see the mealworms, which immature beetle larvae. And so that's great, but they taste wonderful. And then the pièce de résistance, final course, is our umami flavor profile. And this is when you can actually prominently see the insects in the dish. And so Megan has put together a dish that she put together last year. And last year it was voted at that last year's Bugfest. It was voted by the crowd as the most popular dish. So it's back again this year, and it's Oaxaca-inspired, Mexico-inspired grasshopper tacos. And so it'll be tacos made with what in Mexico are known as chapulines, which are roasted lime, citrus, and chili roasted grasshoppers. And that last year was voted as the one to eat. So we're very excited. This is a super popular way. And as I said, you know, this is a way for us to highlight the use of insects as food, as protein source, not as something that you should be grossed out by, not as something that you should be, shocked by, but as an actual, you know, bona fide ingredient in your food.
Well, confession, I've actually had ant bark, chocolate covered ant bark, yes, in the past, and I've had roasted crickets on a stick. Yeah,
you know, what did you think?
It was pretty tasty. Listen, the grasshopper tacos, I think with enough salsa, I could probably...
with enough margaritas, you mean?
My interest in insects as food actually goes a little bit in a different direction. Yeah. I have spent so much time on the rivers here in Utah trying to prove I'm smarter than a trout. My interest lies in how do I make insects as food for fish, for example. And I think it really goes back to that concept of biophilia, right? That humans, we're hardwired to connect with nature. And I'm just, you know, wondering how that also informs conservation efforts or our ability to really understand the biodiversity that insects bring into our life, far beyond my love of trying to imitate a fly for a fish.
But so that's part of it, certainly, isn't it? I mean, it's the idea of understanding and appreciating and being inspired by all things in the natural world, including insects, right? And so whether it's fly fishing and trying to mimic the morphology and behavior of a fly, of an insect when you're trying to catch fish, or if you are a gardener and you're understanding native pollinators and these kinds of things, you know, biophilia, the appreciation, the love of the natural world is reflected in entomology in so many ways. The thing about the science that really is interesting to me about entomology is that insects touch every aspect of human life. So whether it's agricultural, you know, intervention by insects, pollinating foods that we eat and whatnot, health, certainly the medical field, we are so affected and influenced by insect activity in so many ways. the way we live in our homes and you know, just really every aspect of human life is dependent on or affected by insects in so many ways. So again, you know, you get back to this idea of the head, the heart, the hands, right? So you have to understand something to love it. And so if you love something, then you can have an action. You can be inspired to action. And so the conservation of insects is in light of what we spoke about before with the global die-off of insects, you know, pollinator collapse, bee collapse, all of these things that are affecting the natural world and specifically in the insect world that are either caused by or exacerbated by human activity. You know, it really, as we understand and love and are inspired by insects, we have a call to action to help mitigate some of those effects.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. Jason Cryan from the Natural History Museum of Utah about Bug Fest coming up this weekend. And I just wanted to say, not to linger on the bugs as food topic, but I remember years ago we did an interview with a food scientist. And she was working for, she was a local resident in Park City and working for a company that made cricket flour. And I just Googled cricket flour. And if you do that, it got like 6 or 7 different varieties or brands of cricket flour come up, which is so interesting. I wanted to ask you about this summer. You know, it's particularly dry in Utah. I think it's rained about one time in Park City, and that was a very light rain. And I've been noticing these bees outside. I have a flower pot that has a little crack in it, and I think the water's seeping through, and bees are gathering there, and they're not making a nest or, you know, it's not a wasp nest or anything like that, but it's bees, and they're thirsty, I think. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, just like any other organism, you know, bees and other insects have to eat and drink. They have to absorb nutrients that sustain their life. So they are actually very good. Of course, they're, many insects are very good at foraging. And so they will identify food sources and water sources that are good for them and sustain them. And the interesting thing about bees, of course, and social insects, is that they have a relatively sophisticated communication system. And so they can communicate those food sources back to their nest mates and their colony mates. And so so bees will congregate at these little sources. You know, we have in my yard, we recently put out hummingbird feeders, and we do get a few hummingbirds, which is fascinating to watch. But more so, we get bees and wasps coming who have queued into the sugar water as a food source. And so it's as an entomologist, I'm actually okay with that. I'm feeding the hummingbirds, yes, but I'm also providing a nutrition source for pollinators and whatnot. So it's kind of fun to watch that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, gosh, we're about out of time here. And I know that some of the workshops and things like that are already sold out during Bug Fest. I mean, this is a popular event at the Natural History Museum of Utah. And if you haven't been there before, you must go for Bug Fest. What can people still, what's open for folks to partake in?
Absolutely. It's a great question. Thanks for asking. So we have grown this event year over year. And so we're excited to make it just bigger and better and more excited each year. And this year we've added, as you mentioned, several workshops and several kind of components that have, we're very gratified to know that they've already pre-sold out. So we're expecting just, you know, thousands of invertebrate enthusiasts here this weekend. But for things that you don't have to pre-register for that are included in the price of admission, we have all kinds of expert speakers. We'll have scientists who are coming in to speak about their work in the insect world. For the kiddos, we've got face painting and opportunities for great photos with insects. We've got puppets. We have a pollination station where our museum team programs are going to be educating the public all about pollinators. We have opportunities for the public to understand and start using iNaturalist, which is a wonderful app on smartphones to help explore the natural world. just all kinds of things. We've got vendors and artists with art and jewelry and foods and other insect products. There's a lot to be to enjoy here.
Well, Dr. Jason Cryan, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. And you can go to nhmu.utah.edu to see what the events are. It actually starts on Friday. So we've been saying 9th and 10th, right? It's 8th, 9th, and 10th. Excellent.
Thank you so much. It has been a real pleasure, as always, to see you. And thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. Imagine this. In your job, you get so excited about a once-in-a-lifetime career kind of finding. You're so excited about it for 9 straight months. And every time you think about it, you have a hard time sleeping. Enviable, isn't it?
Well, our next guest, Anil Seth, is that person that was so excited. Anil is Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of Utah and the co-principal investigator of a study released last year on Omega Centauri. It's a globular star cluster, one of the largest and oldest in the Milky Way. The thing he is so excited about is the discovery of newly identified fast-moving stars in this Omega Centauri that provide solid evidence for a central black hole in the cluster. He presented his findings last year, and he's back to update us on Cool Science Radio about any further findings in the study. Anil Seth, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, we're really glad to have you back. You know, when I read about the study, it makes me think because I've been into Young Sheldon recently, it makes me feel like I'm in an episode of Young Sheldon. And as he goes through his life trying to get other people excited about what he's excited about, it's a little bit like that, but we should be excited about these kinds of discoveries, shouldn't we?
Yeah, definitely. I think everyone's in their own thing. So, for those of us who are curious about how the universe works, I think this has really been an exciting finding. We have been really excited to be able to present this over the last, year to a bunch of different audiences and really gotten a very, positive reception from that. This ends up affecting a lot of different areas of astronomy. And so that's a pretty exciting part of this discovery of this lowest mass supermassive black hole or an intermediate mass black hole.
Can you explain what an intermediate black hole is as opposed to just a black hole?
Yeah. So through different ways, like seeing stars orbiting around them, we've discovered black holes of different masses. And some of them are little black holes that we call stellar mass black holes. And they're only a few to say 20 times the mass of our sun. And then there's a big gap from about, actually the biggest one is more like 100 times the mass of our sun. There's then a big gap between that and these supermassive black holes that we find at the centers of galaxies, including our own Milky Way. And those are typically millions of solar masses up to billions of solar masses. And so for a long time, there's been this big, from 100 to a million, there's been this big gap in the mass range of black holes that we know about. And that kind of tells us that maybe those two things aren't connected. Maybe they didn't form in the same way. We know how the low mass black holes formed. It came from stars that exploded as supernova. But these high mass black holes, we don't know how they originated. And so that's the reason why this finding is that we're finding an object in the middle of that range that's about 10,000 times the mass of the sun or so. And so that tells us that there must be black holes that exist at that mass range. And then that means there must be some mechanism that can form those black holes.
Wow, 10,000 times the mass of the sun is really kind of hard to get your head around.
Yeah.
What type of technology or equipment are you using to measure this? I mean, this has got to be super delicate research that you're doing.
Yeah. So there was this really fantastic data set that we had from the Hubble Space Telescope that Max Haberle, who's the lead author of the original study, was the person who analyzed 500 different epochs of data from the Hubble Space Telescope that had been taken of this cluster because it was a calibration target for the Hubble Space Telescope. So they basically kept looking back at it to check that their cameras were working okay, because there was lots of bright stars. They could measure how bright they were and see that it was consistent. And that data set ended up being this, you know, being able to, it allowed us to track the motions of stars across the sky through those 500 stars. So basically turning the cluster into a movie, right? So we could watch the stars actually moving on the sky. And then we found that there was these seven stars right near the center that were moving much, much faster than we would expect them to. That if they had been moving that fast for a long time, they should have just left the cluster. They were moving faster than the escape velocity of the cluster. Since that original finding, we've actually been able to get additional data. And in particular, we have data now with the James Webb Space Telescope. We got two different projects with the James Webb Space Telescope, data from those this summer. So one of those is a project I led to get to be able to measure the velocities towards and away from us. And that's from the Doppler effect, which is basically just the same effect that when an ambulance comes towards you and the pitch is higher, and then it moves away from you, past you, and the pitch drops. That's the Doppler effect. And so that same thing can be used to measure the shift of the spectrum of stars and tell us how fast the stars are moving towards and away from us. And so with the James Webb Space Telescope, we can actually use that to measure not just the motion across the sky, but also the motion towards and away from us. So we can get their 3D motion, their full motion through the world.
Well, the Doppler effect that you had mentioned, right? I'm familiar with that in terms of sound. Does that also apply to light?
It does also apply to light. Yeah. And we use it all the time in astronomy. If we know the wavelength of some feature in a spectrum, then we can figure out exactly how fast that feature is moving towards or away from us. So say there's a bright emission line or an absorption from, say, some atom like sodium or something like that, then that will allows us, if we know the rest wavelength, the wavelength that we would measure, say, in a lab on Earth, then we can compare that to the measurement that we have in the star.
Wow. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Anil Seth. He is an associate professor of astronomy at the University of Utah. He's updating us on the discovery of an intermediate black hole. Those findings were published last year. Now, Anil, I wanted to ask you then. So the findings from the photos from the Hubble Space Telescope are now sort of, there's an interplay between what you're finding from the James Webb Space Telescope. And I love to hear this because it's showing how they're complementary, I guess. Yeah. And I think since the James Webb Space Telescope has come online, you know, you tend to wonder if the Hubble Space Telescope is now not as important. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I also just had a new successful Hubble Space Telescope proposal. So I'm very excited for Hubble to keep orbiting and hope that I get that data before it's done. I would say, you know, Hubble is still an unparalleled instrument. There's many capabilities which the James Webb Space Telescope did not replace. The James Webb Space Telescope is a bigger mirror. So that means it collects more light, and so we can see fainter objects and also form sharper images. So the stars get smaller on our images because of the mirror being bigger. So that all is better about the James Webb Space Telescope, but its emphasis is on the infrared wavelengths. So it really focuses on light that is longer wavelength than we can see, so redder than red. And the Hubble really has a amazing capabilities and still unique capabilities. There's no other replacement instrument at optical and UV wavelengths. And we can use those different wavelengths for different things. So for instance, the colors of the stars in this cluster, we've used the Hubble Space Telescope colors and brightnesses in order to age date the stars in that cluster. That was a study my PhD student published in this last year. And we're actually able to track the history of when stars formed around, or maybe the black hole formed afterwards. We don't know for sure, But, you know, we can track the history of when stars formed in this Omega Centauri system over about 3 or 4 billion years.
Wow, that's so great. Okay, well, I think we've heard more of Alpha Centauri. What's the difference between Alpha Centauri and Omega Centauri?
Yeah, so in astronomy, objects are named by the constellation that they're in. So Centaurus is a constellation that you can see from Utah. If you look towards the south in the early part of the summer, that's the best time of year to see it. And the alpha, beta, gamma, that is the Greek alphabet. And that the earlier the letter in the Greek alphabet, the brighter the object. So alpha is the brightest object in the constellation Centaurus. And that is bright because it is also the closest star to us. Wow. Omega Centauri is a fainter star. Like, you wouldn't be able to see it from a city, say. It's pretty, you know, relatively faint. But you can definitely see it with your naked eye. I saw it actually earlier this year from Bryce Canyon. And it's a spectacular object through a small telescope, too. It's one of the prettiest objects you'll look at. So that's why those two objects have the similar sounding designations, is because that's the way we name bright objects in astronomy.
What a great segue into the whole concept of this dark sky initiative, which I know that you're very involved with. So, you know, we're very fortunate to live in Utah, where we do have some spectacular skies here. Can you talk a little bit about the Dark Skies Project, and then in particular, what's going on down at Bryce?
Yeah. I just first want to kind of give a pitch for why dark skies are exciting and important. I mean, of course, they're great for astronomy. If you want to see, you know, thousands of stars in your sky, you have to go to a place that has close to natural darkness, that's not being influenced by artificial light from the lights that we're sending up into the sky from our houses and car dealerships and all that. But that artificial light at night also has a lot of other impacts, in particular on our own health. The human health, that looking at your phone late at night is bad for you. That's generally true. You know, people who live in cities and have bright lights shining through their window get worse sleep. And there's a lot of evidence accumulating that that exposure to light at night can actually lead to other health issues because of the impact on your circadian rhythms, including like higher incidence of cancer and things like that. So there's a lot of human health impacts, and I definitely, you know, encourage all your listeners to try making their rooms as dark as possible at night. You know, don't use a pillow that has light in it or anything like that. I was horrified when someone gave my kid. Yes, someone gave my child a pillow with a light in it. I was like, oh my God. They also have a lot of wildlife impacts. And so, most songbirds migrate at night and they get confused by cities. So that's a really big impact. A lot of birds die by running into windows and getting trapped in cities. And there's also, frogs and sea turtles and lots of other impacts. Insects, one of the possible reasons why insect populations are declining so dramatically right now is related to artificial light at night. Whenever you look at a lamp and you see all those bugs kind of trapped there, that's not probably good for their natural habitat, right? There's a lot of really big impacts there. Yeah, I can talk a little bit about how that's playing, the efforts in Utah to kind of address that issue.
How is this being received in Utah? I mean, we are unique, as Scott was saying. You know, we're lucky that we live here because we do have dark skies relative to lots of other places on Earth. I'm assuming that you viewed Omega Centauri in Bryce at the Bryce Astronomy Festival?
I was down there for the astronomy festival, but it was before that. I was doing training. I run an internship program down there for two students each year who come to Bryce and do astronomy outreach over the summer. And so we were doing a telescope training out on the rim of the canyon. So that was really fantastic. You know, Utah, I think, is a really unique place in terms of its both the large population that's really close to dark sky areas. Like, all of us can drive an hour and a half into the West Desert and be in basically natural darkness. And that's really spectacular. And there's, I would say there's probably nowhere else in the world where a million people can drive an hour and a half and and or 1.5 million people can drive 1.5 hours and get to natural darkness. So that's something that I think many Utahns, you know, most of us have the experience of doing, going out and camping somewhere and appreciating the night sky, appreciating a meteor shower. And, you know, that is something that I think makes us very excited about dark skies. And I think it means that there's been a lot of communities that have really recognized that this is a priority for them. And so, for instance, in this last year, the town of Bluff, Utah has become a dark sky place. So it's a dark sky town now, and there's a designation. There's this group, Dark Sky International, that designates different parks and towns and communities and places as dark sky places. And that they have that designation along with a bunch of other towns in Utah, including Moab and Springdale, Torrey. A lot of these gateway communities to our national parks are really recognized that that this is a big deal, and it's, you know, good for business too. You know, for instance, if you go down to Torrey, you'll see that there's a hotel now whose main theme is they have clear domes and you can sleep inside them and look up at the night sky. Yeah, that's, I think, you know, there's a, it makes it a lot easier to talk about this topic here than in other places because people have such a deep connection and in some cases a real economic motivation for preserving those dark skies.
Yeah, wow, that's a really important effort. That's interesting. You know, here in Park City, you know, we're aware of these designations for cities like the most bikeable community at various levels of of that. But how great to be a dark sky community, being recognized as that. Well, since you mentioned meteor showers, I just wanted to ask you quickly, there's one coming up, a big one, like 1,000 meteors that we're going to be able to see on, I believe it's August 12th and 13th. You're going to have to pronounce it for me. It's from Perseus, right?
Yeah, Perseids is what they're
Perseids.
Called.
The Perseids. Okay, yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so these are kind of maybe the most famous meteor shower because it's in the summertime. So a lot of people are out, you know, camping. I've been out camping just accidentally sometimes while these are going on. And the reason why they're called the Perseids is that that we're passing through a cloud of dust from a comet, and that dust is in the direction of the constellation Perseus as we're, you know, as we're moving around the sun. And so there's a bunch of shooting stars through the sky. So you'll see shooting stars, and those shooting stars will, if you traced back all their lines, they would converge in the constellation Perseus. That's why they're called the Perseids. They're a great opportunity to look up at the sky. They generally are, this year they'll be better in the, you know, after 10 p.m. or so, but there's a kind of competing factor because the moon is going to be, it's a waning moon. And so it will be up in the morning time sky. So that's the one downside is that we won't see, the moonlight can be quite bright. It's also a source of light at night. it can kind of prevent us from seeing those faintest shooting stars, but there still should be plenty visible. I don't think it'll be thousands an hour. It'll be more like 10 to 100 an hour is the kind of typical rate. So some patience is also required still. But one thing I will say is that you can see meteors every night if you go to a dark sky place. Like if you hang out for an hour under a dark sky, you will always, almost always see at least one shooting star.
I will tell you that having camped out with my kids in the past during the Perseid comet shower, it's beautiful. It is absolutely stunning. And it's something I'll always remember doing with my children. Before I let you go, we've talked about Hubble, we've talked about James Webb, we didn't talk about Gemini, but I'm curious, having the Vera C. Rubin Observatory just come online recently, is that another tool that you're also using, or is that too ground-based?
No, absolutely. Not for exactly the same work that we're doing here, because when you have images from the ground, they're blurred out by the atmosphere a little bit. And so that makes this very high resolution measurements very hard. But especially in these crowded environments like Omega Centauri, where there's so many stars all crammed together. But there's this really cool type of event that can happen very rarely in a galaxy where a star will come too close to a black hole and it'll get ripped apart. It's called a tidal disruption event. We've found about 100 of these so far over the last 20 years or so. We found 100 times throughout the universe, you know, where one of these events has happened. And in a typical galaxy, this will happen every million years or so. So it's really a rare event. But because the Rubin Observatory is basically taking a picture of the whole night sky visible from Chile every 3 days. And so it's basically making a movie of the night sky, and we can see things brightening and dimming. And so we actually are expecting to go from having detected 100 over 20 years to detecting, you know, 10 a night of these tidal disruption events. And the reason why that's really exciting to me is because any time an event like that happens, it tells us that there's a black hole in that galaxy. And we should be able to see even small black holes like the one we found in Omega Centauri. We should be able to see events from black holes like that.
Wrapping this up a little bit, we've talked about a lot of exciting things, I think. And in our intro, talking about how excited you were about this study, the discovery of this intermediate black hole in Omega Centauri. You know, we all should hope to have a career where we get that excited about something that we can't sleep. So that's really cool. You know, a year later or so, what is causing you not to be able to get to sleep because you're so excited these days?
I'm definitely sleeping better. I think that it was kind of a once in a career finding. I am really excited about the Rubin Observatory coming online. That they just released their first data a couple months ago, and that data is going to start becoming increasingly useful over time. Right now, they're just in the preliminary stages, and I think they're going to start regular operations this fall. So that's a really exciting new thing. And then I'm really excited about our new data that we have. We actually have data from two James Webb projects, and then also a project telescope called the Atacama Large Millimeter Array in Chile. The goal of that project and one of the James Webb projects is to try finding the material that's falling onto the black hole in Omega Centauri. So that would allow us to pinpoint the black hole. Right now, we don't really know exactly where it is. We know in the region it is, but that would allow us to pinpoint it. It would also tell us how much gas is in the cluster and some other really exciting things. So I think that's one of the things that I'm most excited about right now.
Yeah, that's really cool. Why should the average person care about a black hole? What's important for us to know about that?
Yeah, I think to me, the coolest thing about black holes is that they're the most efficient way to turn mass into energy in the universe. So when stuff falls onto a black hole, in the process of that, as it falls into the black hole, it's losing converting potential energy into kinetic energy. Is like a rock falling down and starting to move faster. And that kinetic energy ends up getting turned into light as the friction forces of the material that's falling onto the black hole, you know, interact with each other. And that light ends up being 10% of the mass energy of the stuff falling into the black hole can actually be radiated away. For comparison, when we turn hydrogen into helium, which is what happens in our sun to generate energy, it's less than 1% of the mass of the hydrogen is going into helium, right? So this is that's really cool. And that also means these black holes play really important roles in these galaxies, because as material falls onto them, as they're sitting at the centers of galaxies, they end up influencing the whole galaxy. So that's one of the reasons I am most excited about supermassive black holes in particular.
Oh, that's really cool. So, or from any of these, you know, whether it's the Hubble or the James Webb, when matter falls onto a black hole, how do you see it? How are you able to see it from a photograph or from the a telescope?
Yeah. So, I mean, they can be really bright, you know, because it can be 10% of the mass that's falling onto it is turned into energy. That's a lot of light. So in fact, when a lot of material is falling onto a black hole, it can be brighter than a whole galaxy. So quasars are the objects where that's happening are called quasars. And they're, you know, often 100 times brighter than the whole galaxy that they're in. And so then it's really not hard to tell. You know, we've known about them for 60 years now, that these objects exist. But the problem is that not all black holes have a lot of material falling onto them. And so in order to track the black holes, we can only track those ones that where there is a bunch of material dumping onto them at that moment. 90% of the other black holes, you can't find that way at all.
Cool science right there. Anil Sepp has been our guest. He is Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of Utah. Anil, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.